and welcome to Aldi's Mamia and Me podcast. I'm Jen Hogan, and today I'm joined by Irish rugby legend, Limerick coffee roaster, author and father of three, Keith Earls. Today we'll be chatting about life off the pitch, his mental health advocacy, children and sport, and life at home with daughters Ella Mae, Laurie and Emmy. So Keith, thanks a million for joining us. We are thrilled you're here. And I even have a few friends who are fairly envious of the fact that I'm getting to interview you. So thanks for that too. Keith, come here, tell us, how are you getting on since you finished up with the rugby?
Yeah, good, Jen. I've been very busy adapting to the real world as you'd like to call it.
Busy
with coffee and adjusting to, I suppose, having my own schedule and the freedom of a schedule. But I'm really enjoying it.
And are you missing the rugby at all? Like, it must be a huge adjustment. The whole thing. Actually, I can't even narrow it down. The whole thing must be huge to adjust to.
Yeah, it was a big, massive part of my life for, you know, you could say 20 years. Mm. And just to be gone with the click of a fingers last October. But I missed the lads. I missed the crack. Mm. I missed competing. And But I certainly don't miss the pain the body was going through every day from training. And look, I'm enjoying my free weekends as well. But yeah, so yeah, I do miss it, but I'm enjoying life.
What's it like being a spectator, though? I mean, did you find it hard, like, kind of watching the recent matches and as a spectator rather than?
Yeah, it's amazing how rugby took over so much part of my life. You know, it was 24/7. For, you know, many years. And when I retired, it's only that 80 minutes that I care about now.
Yeah.
And it's really kind of irrelevant to my life as well. Obviously, keep in touch with the lads and keep an eye on them. But that's what I can't believe, how irrelevant rugby is in my life now. Towards it was absolutely everything. And that's the thing I'm finding, I suppose, most difficult, just being completely away from it. How can we just gone?
Are you tempted to get involved? Like, even, I suppose, you've the three kids, would you be tempted to get involved in coaching sports at all?
Yeah, I do. I go through phases of wanting to coach in rugby, and I think I do maybe want to get involved, but at what level, I'm not sure. I suppose the coffee business isn't freeing me up either. But yeah, I go. I've three girls at home. Two of them are playing soccer now, so I'm not officially a coach. But yeah. I go up, and you know, I'll help out the coaches if they ask me. But I like being around, and that's probably the biggest thing for me, is being able to wake up Saturday morning and bring the girls to soccer and sit down and watch them.
And all those sort of things, I suppose, that the rest of us kind of take for granted, you know, because everybody's looking at you and your very illustrious career and going, that's deadly. Like, I mean, imagine being that skilled. But the simple things, I suppose, that the rest of us get to just kind of take for granted, like standing on the wet sidelines on a dreary Saturday or Sunday morning, but you get to enjoy that. And now you're working with your wife too. How is that? How's that going?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. Yeah, been with each other 24/7. Look, thankfully we get on and we can have the crack together. Yeah. But it doesn't help when we start talking business at 9:30 just before we go to bed, and we're still talking business at 1:00 in the morning. Like, you know, so we have to we put a few procedures in place that, you know, when we leave the coffee roastery and the shop, that's it. We get back to being husband and wife, and I suppose parents to the three girls as well. Now, that's easier said than done. It's not perfect. It creeps in every now and then, but you know, we're trying our best.
But I'd say, like, it must be really hard, because I think a lot of us got a little bit of a taste of spending more time with our other half during the pandemic, you know, when maybe some of them worked from home, or there was that kind of shift in working patterns, or some people even were unfortunate enough to be at home, maybe jobs lost and stuff. But for you now to make this transition where you would have been away from home a lot with work to be working, to be rearing your family, it's just as well you grew up together, isn't it?
We've been blessed, you know, in the last couple of months, you know, with the World Cup.
Yeah.
I'd been away for, you know, weeks on end.
Yeah.
And then, you know, coming home at the end of October and then going straight into the real life. Mm. you know, we've been around each other since. And, you know, you just adapt. Yeah. You just adapt. She wasn't used to me being around. I wasn't used to being around her. I wasn't used to being around Edel's rules around the house. So, you know, she, I have to get used to her cleaning routine and how she operates rather than me being a slob around the place and vice versa. We genuinely just have honest conversations. Yeah. and we adapt and we push on.
I know you're becoming very domesticated too.
I'm getting quite good with the Hoover. I know she still thinks I can do more, but I'm not left near the washing machine because I mix up all the colours and all that.
There's something about washing machines. That's the same in our house. Yeah. It's like, I don't know if it's a learned helplessness or what's going on there. I'm a bit suspicious, but there's a thing about the washing machine that nobody in our house has managed to master it yet. And it's a fairly simple piece of machinery.
I've tried to help out a couple of times. I think it's the washing machine's easy to use. It's just Edel's routine. That's the issue. Yeah. So I try and help and throw on a couple of washes, and you know, it kind of messes up her routine a bit. So I'm like, well, I'm trying to help you, but I'll step away if you want me to. So Edel's all over the washing machine. Mm. And I'll try and fly around the Hoover and the mop
and get used to it all. When you have, I suppose, had time to get used to the washing machine, Hoover and the likes, and I'm going to go back to the kids' sports one here again, because this is something, I suppose, that I know myself, even as a mam, I'm very passionate about, and a few of our listeners were in touch ahead of today to talk about the kids' sports and when you might perhaps get involved. If you get involved, here I am going, you should definitely get involved in coaching in kids' sports. And if the coaches aren't completely intimidated by the fact that Keith Earls might get involved in coaching kids. But is there something, if you're watching it and you're seeing your children play sports, and I know you mentioned one of your kids beforehand is playing soccer and really into it, and one of your other daughters get really into sport as well now too. Would you ever see things maybe on the sidelines that concern you around, I suppose, inclusion or things like that? Or would you have any kind of feelings around getting our kids involved in sport? Because we know keeping our kids or getting all our kids involved in sports, we know there are lifelong benefits. We know there's huge mental health benefits, which I know we're going to chat about later on. There's the physical health benefits. There's the friendship, the social benefits. There's so much about getting kids involved in sport. And for some reason, we always have these children who feel that they're on the periphery. They're on the outside. They're sometimes left on the sidelines. They feel they don't have a place in sport. As somebody whose sport was such a huge part of your life, would you have any thoughts if you were to get involved in coaching yourself, or any advice maybe for coaches who are coaching children on how we might make it a more inclusive place for children?
Yeah, it's a tough one, and I suppose I had to nearly, you know, wind myself in as well a couple of times watching my daughters playing, and because I still had the professional mindset. Yeah. And if I seen particular one of my daughters who's only playing under eights,
yeah,
like, you know, under nines, and I had a professional mindset, and I was kind of half giving out or half telling her what to do. But I just need to step back. I think for kids, it's just all about having fun, having the crack. Obviously, there's an element of, you know, yeah, they need to be coached as well. Like, you know, and like the club, my girls are at Ashley Nanakati, they're bringing a lot of fun into it with a bit of technical as well. And then different ways of learning. Some people learn on a board, some people see visuals, some people, and I suppose that's the thing for the coaches is understanding that kids learn differently. Some will develop early, some will develop late, and I suppose patience is a big thing. But the competitive aspect of things, maybe it's my nature, I like competitiveness, but you know, I think we have to leave them enjoy the sport, leave them build relationship, leave them build their confidence before they get into that, maybe, you know, as they get a bit older, maybe, you know, 13, 14, 15. I suppose that's the advice I have. I try, and when I'm standing on the sideline now and I'm watching Laurie playing soccer and she does something good, she just does something bad, she's looking over to me looking for reassurance. Yeah. And I just try and keep a blank face, leave her figure it out herself. Yeah. And leave her, you know, my emotions are going to be different than hers. So if I'm annoyed or I'm happy about something, you know, she might not. So I don't want to, I suppose, have influence on it unless she wants to ask me.
It's real honest of you to say that, because I imagine it must be, as again, going back, you're an elite athlete. The rest of us can only dream of being, of being good at sport, even in my case, of being able to kick a ball straight. I suppose if I'm thinking about it, for the parents that might be listening or watching this who do tend to get carried away a little bit kind of with that competitiveness, how do you rein it in? How do you keep things like that in check?
Yeah, I just sit there blank. I'll have the conversation in my head, but I want to see my girls figure it out themselves. Like, you know, I want to see them when they make a mistake or they do something good, especially if they make a mistake, how they can be, I suppose, build the resilience without telling me, oh, you'll be all right, you're good. Like, you know, I think they need to learn how to lose. They need to learn how to make mistakes. And, you know, and as I said, Laurie, my little girl, and even the LMA as well, who's starting to play, her asking me questions. Yeah. And I know it might be a bit ruthless out of me, and mothers and fathers might be thinking it's ruthless out of me, but I have to be, I'll be honest with them, because I want them to understand, I suppose, when they didn't do something good, maybe show them why they didn't do it good, and leave them build resilience, or sometimes leave them figure it out themselves. And, you know, my philosophy of going about things might go against the coaches as well. So I just take a step back and, I suppose, leave my girls go on their own journey until they want to ask for my advice.
And what about, I suppose, the coaches then? Because like you said there, that whole different philosophy that you might have versus theirs, and the same for parents, you will see those differences of opinion, shall we say, on the sidelines, where maybe you've got a child who's standing there and they're not getting some fair play time, and you've got a coach who really wants to win. If you were coaching, how would you manage that?
I think it's important to give the kids the opportunity to get out and, you know, training's fine, but then some people, kids get a kind of mental block about playing a game and their confidence. You know, I even have it with LMA now, my eldest girl who's getting into soccer, and she's loving training, but she's like, I'm not sure about a match yet. So her confidence, you know, I'm like, just like, you're training, there's no difference. You're just playing against a different team, and go and do what you do in training. But you have to allow them to get involved, you know, until, I don't know, when those things get really, really competitive, like, you know, at what age. I think it's important to teach kids to be competitive, but, you know, some people are late bloomers.
Yeah.
You know, they mightn't be so good for a couple of years, and then next thing they just come back after a couple of months, and They're different players. So I just make sure and get them all involved. Give everyone a fair crack at playing or training or whatever, and accept that some kids are going to be good. Some kids might need to progress more, and you know, you just have to figure that out.
I love that. I love the idea though of everybody getting that, feeling part of the team, and getting to, you know, getting the fair play, even if the coach really wants to win. I suppose it's about, like you said, their main trigger.
Yeah, you have to be careful, I suppose, how competitive you make it, how competitive you are as a person, because if a child isn't ready and you put them on and then they give away a penalty or they miss kick something, and then maybe a bit of
They live with that
and maybe a bit of slagging happens. So it's
actually it's interesting you say that, even the penalty, because my own husband, he coaches like a younger team, I think they're under eights, and they had a cup match recently, and I know all the parents on the sidelines, everybody was there praying it wouldn't go to penalties, because nobody wants to think of a child going home and being the one who missed the penalty, being, you know, that hanging over a small kid, and It being the thing that they take away from the match instead of maybe having had fun with their friends or got to play. It seems a really
cruel. But then again, I'm a believer that they need to learn to be resilient.
You've got to learn to lose, you know, and you've got to learn that you just don't want to be the one who misses the penalty.
that's why you need to practice.
That's the other side of practice, absolutely. Can I ask you a little bit about why rugby? Why was rugby the big draw for you, and how did you actually get involved in rugby?
I grew up around rugby. My father was, you know, I suppose he'd be well respected in Limerick as a club rugby player. He played for Munster a couple of times. And, you know, I grew up around, you know, he's only 20 years older than me. So I grew up around him. I grew up getting to watch him play. Yeah. I played a game of rugby with him. It was in the family. I grew up a stone throw away from Thomond Park. Yeah. So Thomond Park was my playground when I was younger after school. And then Thomond, my club, one of the lads from the club came down one day when I was 8 years of age and said to my father, is he ready? Does he want to come up and play? And I haven't looked back since.
From eight?
Yeah, from eight, yeah.
Oh, wow. And did your, I suppose you're saying now your dad played rugby, or you explain your dad played rugby. So if it was in the family, maybe there wasn't that kind of hesitancy around it. But, you know, nowadays there's a lot of focus on rugby and the idea of children playing rugby and the potential injuries that they have or that they could have, things like concussion. We talk about concussion and stuff and a lot of worries about that. Maybe a bit more discussion going on about rugby now. Was that ever a worry for you? Is it a worry for you if your girls decided to play rugby or anything?
No, it's like we know the risks. Yeah. We know the rules of the game. We know the risks. And again, it comes down to the proper coaching at a younger age. You know, the tackle and the headbangs are a big issue. And you can see now during the Six Nations, they're starting to wear gum shields as professional rugby players. So if it's a certain velocity of a hit, you're off to see if you've got a concussion, you know. So I've got a couple of bangs in the heads. Yeah. Thankfully, nothing too serious. And look, I think my girls have picked the right sport as well. They're into soccer, so hopefully it stays like that.
A few less head bangs, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But again, I can understand why parents would be worried, but know the rules of the game.
It's not enough to put you off playing rugby, and it wasn't enough.
Yeah, exactly.
And in turn, were any of your friends playing rugby or anything when you were growing up? Was it a group of you started together, or was it largely just because your dad was involved in rugby that you were drawn to it?
Yeah, no, my father never pushed rugby on me. Even when I played rugby, I was always soccer anyway myself. Yeah. But he turned around to me one day. I remember I was penned out on the couch, falling asleep, in between sessions. I was after playing rugby with the school, and I was coming home for a sleep to go play soccer with the club. And he was like, "Look, you're going to get burnt out. Pick one. It doesn't matter which one you're going to pick. Pick the one you enjoy the most." But he said, "You have to choose, because you're going to get burnt out, and you'll end up like in none of them. You'll give up both, or you'll get injured, and you mightn't be able to do any of them." So look, thankfully I played rugby, and I had a great bunch of friends that played in Thomond RFC as well. Mm. So we, you know, from literally under 8s, 9s, 10s, we played with each other the whole way up to under 20s, and a good few of us at senior level for Thomond as well, which was quite unique.
Like that growing up with the group of pals, like, it's like that kind of camaraderie sort of thing. Was that really important to you growing up, having rugby in your life?
Yeah, it was huge. It was huge. You got to, obviously all the lads who I hung around with, I went to school around with, and you got to meet lads who were going to a different school out the country and came in to play with Thomond, and you're getting to meet different personalities from different areas of their city, from where they're growing up, and different kind of communities. So it's a great sport, and even the friends I had now, and even going through the whole professional, the world that sport and rugby has opened my eyes to, so I'll be forever grateful.
Can I ask you a little bit about growing up? A little bit. I know you've spoken before. You grew up in Moyross, and can I ask you a little bit about combining that as in playing rugby with growing up and the sort of impact that it had on your adolescence?
Yeah, like for rugby, it was a great distraction for us. Obviously, Moyross had its issues in my teen years, with a lot of violence and drugs. And, you know, when I used to see the lights on in Thomond Park at night time, we were straight over watching, you know. So it was a massive distraction for what was going on around Moyross. And, you know, it certainly gave me a certain goal. You know, when I was seeing Munster performing and being on TV and getting to European Cup finals in, you know, 99, 2000, you know, we were starting to look at positives, which was only around the corner from us. And, you know, my father would have played against all the lads who had been playing for Munster and played with some of them. And I knew Paul O'Connell growing up, and I would have had access to all the Munster players after school. They'd train in Thomond Park, and I'd jump over the wall, and Rod, Ron O'Gara, we'd be out. He was a superstar at the time. Mm. We'd finish school, go over, and we'd be kicking the balls back to him. So I don't think the lads in that Munster team, or the lads in Munster, realised the outlet they gave a lot of young lads like us growing up in around the difficult times.
I've heard you before say about with Moyross, and that you don't like, you know, you don't want to, Moiros is more than just perhaps a reputation that it has, and the people that are in Moiros and stuff, and you're quite protective of the area itself. But growing up there, do you think any of the experiences you had growing up or what life was like as you were growing up impacted you as a person and who you became?
Yeah, it did. It would have had a negative impact on me, because some of the stuff we seen, some of the stuff we were around, it was just normal and we never spoke about it. And I suppose some of the stuff you've seen, you just keep in the back of your mind and you don't speak about it. And until years later, and you start opening up, and you're like, or when I'm playing rugby and I'm going traveling around and I'm meeting lads who grew up in different areas, I'm like, I had a great childhood, like, don't get me wrong, but like, and I never make my Ross out to be something that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I have to be honest, it was a dangerous place to live.
Yeah.
But it wasn't everyone inside my Ross. So, I would have had a negative impact on, you know, anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of paranoia, which I would have kept in for years. And then, you know, it'll explode years later if you don't talk about it. I'm like, my parents were great. I was well able to speak to them about stuff, you know, and they were very protective and always done right by me. Mm-hmm. So like, be a lot to be thankful there for them as well. But I suppose they weren't professionals for some of the things we'd seen. It was normal to us, but yeah, it would have impacted negatively until years later. Then, like, you start figuring it all out and saying that wasn't right.
That's a really hard thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm a mum of boys too. I have a daughter and I have six sons, and I often think about things like mental health and boys and men too. You know, that I don't know if we've maybe got a little bit better about encouraging our girls to talk about things. I don't know if we have. I'd like to think we have, and maybe there's, even going back to stereotypes, the fact that girls can sometimes feel it's a little bit easier to be open because maybe it's a little bit more acceptable to be open. When you're a boy or a man, a teenage boy or a young man either, even going through this and trying to deal with different mental health challenges, it can be really hard to know where to turn. And I think as a parent of sons, watching my sons grow up and looking at the different challenges that face boys as well as girls, obviously, in the world, I often wonder how do you as a parent, like, kind of approach that sort of thing with your boys? Like, how do you have those conversations? Is it the sort of thing, I mean, from your own experience, was it that you had to be ready to talk to somebody about it? Would there have been questions that might have helped to prompt you to feel that you could talk about any difficulties that you're experiencing?
No, I suppose that's saying, you know, it's when you hit rock bottom, you kind of know. And that's what happened to me. I think I was in around, I was maybe 22, 23 at the time. But like, so I held on to all stuff from, it's not, you know, I held on to, you know, people passing away. My family had young people passing away. There was suicide in the family. And then with the whole stuff in my Ross as well. And, you know, never, ever spoke about it. And, you know, I just got into a certain way of thinking, certain negative way of thinking, you know, thinking the whole world was against you. And when you're thinking like that for years, it has to give way at some stage. Mm. And I remember I was a professional rugby player and I went and I spoke to our doctor, Anna Falvey, in Carton House one time. And I was like, look, I don't feel well. I don't want to be here. I said, I'm representing my country. I just don't feel well. I don't know what's going on with me. And and I went and you know, he organised and I went and spoke to someone, and you know, and that helped, you know, and that's the hardest. It's the hardest thing to do is to go and ask for help, but it's, in a way, it's the most easiest thing to do, and it's the best thing to do as well. You know, there's, you know, I know we're here now. If there's anyone watching, I just knew, like, I never had suicidal thoughts or anything like that, but I knew I was so low that I needed to do something about it. And, you know, and going to speak to someone was the best thing I've ever done. But it's that first step is the hardest thing. But then realising as well, like, life is tough and life is about suffering, and you're not happy 24/7. Mm. I would have been kind of miserable for 24/7, you know, and that was just from my own kind of catastrophic thinking and, you know, catastrophic patterns that were in my own head. that I knew I needed to change before it got really serious.
Did you, when you say that you hit rock bottom, I suppose for somebody who's maybe watching someone who they think is struggling, or for somebody who's going through it themselves, anybody who might be listening or watching us today, how did that materialize for you? Like, what were you feeling when you say it was rock bottom? What was the thing that prompted you to go, I have to talk to somebody, I have to get help?
I was sitting in Carton House as an Irish international rugby player, with everything at my feet, yeah. and I wasn't happy. So I was like, there has to be something wrong here. And I was constantly thinking, you know, I was always, as I said, I was in patterns of just constantly thinking negative. You know, going to someone and speaking is great, is probably the most important thing, but it's all the other stuff as well around. Yeah. You know, it's just not, there isn't just one pill that's going to fix something. I went on medication for a couple of years. I wasn't feeling happy or sad or anything, but like for me, for living, it's important for me to feel happy, sad, emotional. I want to feel it all and deal with it all as well. Like, you know, and that's what living is, and that's what we're here to do. So I was on medication for a couple of years. I'm medication free now, nearly 2 years, because I've worked so hard on myself, as I said, and I've fallen back into patterns again where I think, oh, I'm good now. And then, you know, 2 months down the line, I can feel some stuff and behaviors creeping back in again, and I get back on the wagon. So I think it's a constant work on, and you know, obviously some people are luckier than other people. They can just, I suppose, they can manage emotions differently than other people, and I have my mechanisms, but I know that I'm not always going to be happy.
Yeah.
And I know everyone's not always going to be happy. And then, you know, all the social media for the younger kids now isn't going to help with that either.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we often, I think that maybe even the social media is guilty of making us think that 99% of our lives should be going around being a bit like this, and life is, and the reality of life isn't that you're bouncing all over the place. But when you have those moments where you feel yourself slipping, or that maybe it's not maybe a particularly good day, do you get scared?
No, I don't. I don't, because I know I've been there before, and I know what to do, and I'll ring someone. Huh. I have a list of one or two fellas and that I can ring and say, you know, I'm feeling like this, or I'll speak to Adele and she'll say, look, get back on it. We've not, like, or even Adele would notice sometimes.
Yeah, she'll spot.
I might notice, will Adele will spot it, or she can even see sometimes the look in my eyes, and she'll tell me. And I now know after a couple of years of, you know, of writing down stuff, what works for me. Yeah. And when I'm doing that, you know, as I said, like, there's more good days than bad days, but accept the bad days. And it's not even the bad days. I think I'm only having bad moments now, like, you know, and you can change a moment.
So do you journal?
I journal, yeah.
And you find that helpful?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I would have been massive, into it, you know, a couple of years ago, every morning, every night. I've probably done it a bit too much, but, you know, it just helped my pattern of thinking, journaling, and even some of the best conversations I've ever had or have been with myself, you know, constantly talking positive to myself and stuff like that, and kind of changing patterns, you know, leaving something small.
You've been diagnosed with bipolar, isn't that right?
Yeah, I have been, but I've gone on a whole new journey now as well since, like, you know.
Can I ask what that's like? Because I think bipolar is probably one of those things that maybe people aren't as familiar with. You know, we hear and we talk a lot more about depression, but perhaps bipolar is one that we don't hear about as much. Mm. How, if you're having a difficult moment or a difficult day, how does that materialize for you as somebody with bipolar?
Yeah, so that's the thing. I haven't, like, when I wrote my book and I came out with that, and I've went on a whole new journey since my book as well. Yeah. And I went and I spoke to different people. People approached me about my book, and a psychologist came to me, and he goes, you know, they went down the completely opposite route of what they would have learned in college. So when I would have went in to speak to the psychologist, he would ask me what's wrong with me.
Okay.
And I tell him what's wrong with me, and I'm not saying this is a wrong thing. This was just my journey, you know. But the question he asked me, what was wrong with me, and I told him, and he was like, okay, maybe you'd be bipolar, mild form bipolar. And I'm like, oh yeah, great. So it's labelled. Whereas after my book, a psychologist approached me and he asked me, would I go and speak to a woman in his practice? And I went, yeah. And the question was, what happened to you? And I speak about, I spoke about all the tragedy, spoke about growing up in Moyross, and I'd been with her for 3 months. And I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Like, why haven't I done this when I was younger? Yeah. You know, and I'm not blaming, maybe the system needs to look at something as well. Mm-hmm. But I went and I spoke with her for about 3 months. And I was like, how do I undiagnose myself bipolar? Was I misdiagnosed? You know, I think we have to be careful with the way we label. And don't get me wrong, people need medication and people do get diagnosed, but you can't throws all into the one bracket. Mm-hmm. So now the last 2 years, I have been medication free. So how can I be bipolar?
I think as you say that, I'm thinking back to what you just said there about children learning differently and children developing differently. And I suppose that huge difference that there is within mental health difficulties and mental health diagnoses. And as I'm asking you questions about bipolar, I don't really know a huge amount about it. And it's that same thing I'm hearing from you, that people have such different experiences and you're going through, like, things have been really great for you at the moment.
Yeah.
Your children, in terms of you managing all this, and I suppose if I'm being honest, I often think back when I have my own kids, I had postnatal depression after 6 of the 7 of them. And when I say it's one of the things that I beat myself up as a parent over, probably more than most things, the idea that during their early years I was struggling, or during their early months I was struggling and I didn't want help. I was like your worst patient. I actually knew it was happening. I still didn't want to help. And if I'm even to draw that back to my own experience, I can totally relate to that's how I was at that time. So, but I wasn't doing the things that I needed to do to get better. I wasn't doing that either. I was not in the right place. It's something, I suppose, as when the kids got older, I talked to them maybe a little bit about, or the older ones would certainly be aware that was my experience when I had them. But for you, living with, not being aware of the mental health challenges that you're dealing with, it's an ongoing thing. Even as you are going through good times at the moment, it's an ongoing thing, but you're very aware of needing to recognise the signs. Is it something that your children are aware of? Is it something that you have a discussion with your kids about?
Yeah, and Edel is amazing at this as well. And we know Edel texts a girl from school, how was your day? How was this? Any drama? Any, you know, is there anything? And we're kind of like, I suppose we're like parents who we're trying to be friends with the girls rather than, you know, be, I suppose, but like at the end of the day, we look after them, like, you know, but we constantly ask them questions and we're constantly vulnerable to them, and we're telling them, be curious, to be vulnerable. And at the end of the day, it's all about them being able to trust us and open up to us. And, you know, that's the relationship we're trying to have with the girls. We'll speak about anything.
We're winners, baby. We've won the National Parenting Product Award for Best Family Supermarket. From our fabulous Mamiya range of organic food, nappies, wipes and snacks, to our pocket-friendly groceries, parents across Ireland know that Aldi is the perfect place to shop. And now we've got the trophy to prove it. What else could you wish for from our Mamiya range? A podcast? Way ahead of you. And that's a winner too. Honestly, we couldn't be nappier. Aldi, every day amazing.
If you were having, I suppose, where I'm kind of getting at it, if you were having a day, and it sounds like you are very much in tune with something that a lot of parents aren't, they're in tune with it, but they're not acting on it, the need to mind yourself, like the need, like, to know that you have value too, and that you need to do the things to mind yourself as a person as well. If you were having a difficult day, or a day that you thought, you know what, I just need to be a little bit more aware and I need to be in tune with myself and do whatever it is I need to do, whatever, to make me feel in a better place, would your girls be aware of that? Would you go, I need to take a bit of time out, or I need to, is this something that you have conversations with them about so that they're aware how dad feels sometimes, or is it something that you haven't broached?
They're clever. They're clever, my girls, because like my personality, I still like know with especially the business in the real world. You know, the coffee can be stressful, and especially when I'm only like the roastery is open two and a bit years, but I've only been really in it since October.
Yeah.
And so like I'm just starting all over again, and I get frustrated and I'm trying to understand it, and I come home and there's nothing worse when you come home. And that happened to me a couple of months ago. And that's what I'm saying. Sometimes you kind of lose your what you're doing. You think you're good. I came home and Laurie was like, please don't be grumpy today.
Okay.
Because she would have been used to me on the phone or on something or giving out or something around coffee or being stressed about coffee, or myself and Adele disagreeing about coffee or... And that struck a chord with me. And so the girls, they pick up on our emotions and, you know, our emotions and our energy can rub off on the girls as well. Girls know when I'm stressed, I'll go and do a bit of breath work and all that. And so they're always kind of asking, why are you doing breath work? Yeah. And I tell them, well, I was just stressed and you need a bit of space to clear the mind. And, you know, you write things down, 10 things might be driving me mad and I'll write them down and... You know, you see which ones I can control, you know, and there's probably not too many of them I can control. Yeah. So why am I bloody worrying about them? Like, you know, so.
Control the controllables.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm very, and again, it's not all the time. I'm turning out to try and speak like I'm the perfect father here. I'm far from it. I know what I should be doing and I probably only do it maybe 70% of the time. Because I'm quite aware what the girls can pick up off myself and Edel as well. And, you know, all the stuff I do is to give them the best chance as well. So if I'm not looking after myself and I'm grumpy and I'm sick or I'm stressed, what hope have the girls?
I'm going to bring you back to the real world that you've brought up a few times, back to the real world. And really a measure of, are you the perfect father or not? How many nappies has Keith Earls changed?
Did
you do your share?
I've changed hundreds. Yeah, yeah.
Good man. You didn't avoid that side of things.
No, I didn't.
Keith Earls, Ireland International. I don't do nappies. That didn't wash with the Dell.
No, but what's the point in having kids if you're not going to change nappies? That's not fatherhood, is it?
And what about, I suppose, things like you're back now and you're able to be around and you're back in the real world as what's real world for most of us. Obviously, rugby was very much your real world too for a time. Did you ever struggle with things like dad guilt? Was that being away from the kids, was that hard? Were there things that you missed?
It was tough. It was tough at times, you know, when you're away weeks on end. You know, you're missing birthdays, you're missing important days, you're missing first days of school. You know, the guilt would creep in, but you just figure out a way. Like, you know, the sacrifices we made, especially now with the RFU as well, and Andy Farrell, the way he has his so family orientated, that, you know, we made big sacrifices going into the World Cup, but our family's got to come, you know, our families were all part of the big days and...
Amazing experiences to be part of.
Like, you know, my girls getting to see, you know, Paris, Shelburne, they've travelled all over Europe. They've been to big occasions in Thomond Park, Aviva. They've been on the field. You know, that's, you know, and see their smile on their faces after just to see you perform around the field and them in awe of the whole experience. That makes it all worthwhile. But You do get guilt because we do have some cracking camp when you're guilt at home and Edel's at home and two out of three kids are sick and I'm up in Carton House having to crack with the lads is you can get a bit guilty.
Hard life if someone's got to live it, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Moments like that. But do the girls ever get a kick out of you being recognised when you're out, or are they embarrassed?
Yeah, I suppose they do. They do, and they'll be like, why are you people coming up to you getting pictures with you? Or just be like, so naive, or like, what's it like being famous? And I'm like, I'm not famous.
You are famous.
they get a good kick out of it. And I think they miss it as well. They found it hard at the start when I retired. They didn't want me to retire. I suppose because the
love, big adjustments the whole, all their life.
Yeah, that, so when you're thinking about me adjusting, the girls are adjusting to have me around as well, and you know, watching Munster and Ireland playing, and I'm not playing, and I'm watching it on TV with them, and so it was a big adjustment for them as well.
And Adele, I mean, as well as the adjustment for having you back at home, you two met when you were only babbies.
Yeah, yeah, 12.
Oh my 12, God, yeah. How did that happen?
It's one of my buddies gone up to go on a date, if you can have a date at 12 years of age with Adele's sister.
Yeah.
So in Thomond where we played my rugby, you know, Woodview, it was in the middle of Woodview and Moyross and Fitzgerald Stadium was in the middle. So I'd been playing there for years underage, and I never opened my eyes to see what was up on the right hand side, you know, a whole new world. It was just all kind of the Moyross side for me. And we were actually playing in an under 12s final, and you know, because as the game was gone, you could see all these girls gathering at the side of the field, and you know, calling out my buddy's name, and my buddy was like, "Can you come with me? I'm going up meeting a girl." Yeah. And I went up, and Adele was there, and I met Adele as well, and we took a liking to each other, and the rest is history.
Was there a confirmation card?
Yeah, there was a confirmation. Yeah, I know she was a keeper. She gave me a tenner for my confirmation. So
I love that.
I know she was a keeper. I knew she was a good one.
How to snag yourself an Ireland Rugby International and give a confirmation card and a tenner.
Yeah, that's it. So look, it's been a crazy journey with Adele, and
you really did grow up together.
Yeah, we did.
And now you have a daughter who's the same age as you were when you got together with Adele. Does that feel weird, like to have, you've got a child on the cusp of the teenage years? How are you finding rearing girls?
Yeah, it's scary, knowing that she was 12 and she come in with a boyfriend any minute. Hopefully not for a couple of years yet, but yeah, it's, you know, genuinely something myself and Adele spoke about since we were 14 years of age was having kids young.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were young having me, and I was always...
And you were very young by today's standards to have the girls.
We were 23, 24, but we probably would have went earlier if we had a chance.
Yeah.
It's great, you know, I suppose having the energy to look after three girls being young as well.
You need
a lot. Regards to rearing girls, I just have to sit there and take it all in and have no opinion. And,
that'll serve you well,
exactly.
I can tell you, in the teenage years.
Yeah, hand them over to you, Del, when you know, stuff does hit the fan.
It is fun. Yes, having raised a daughter, it is the teenagers. And having been a teenage girl as well, I suppose I have insights a little bit into what it's like.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever worry about, I suppose, very different times that we're rearing kids in, full stop, whether it's girls or boys, but as a dad of girls, is there anything in particular that you feel you need to be really in tune with?
Big worries is the social media.
Yeah.
You know, I've got my opinions. I think certainly stuff needs to be done around social media, what our kids can have access to, and, you know, certain rules around what's real and what can be said. But, and then it's the access that, you know, that maybe some grown men could have, you know. And look, again, it's not every time, but try and give the girls the best chance of being kids and, not get sucked into the social media world.
Do you see a difference now, even to back when maybe yourself and Adele were younger, to girls in sports and the whole attitudes towards getting girls involved in sports? I know your own daughters obviously are involved in sport, but do you see a shift there towards getting them involved in sports, or do you have any thoughts yourself on how we can keep our girls involved in sports? Because you know yourself, there's a big drop off with all kids when they hit the teenage years, but girls in particular, and you have a child coming up to that age. Have you any thoughts around that?
Yeah, no, look, I've heard that from the coaches that girls' sports, we're in Aisteen and Anacotti, you know, my girls are there and they train on Mondays and Fridays between 6 and 7. Mm. And the whole pitch is just covered with girls. Yeah. There's no boys there. It's there, like, I mean to say, there's could be 300 kids, three girls on the pitch. And it's amazing to see. And, you know, you see the standards of the I suppose, and the recognition the girls are getting in England for soccer. Mm-hmm. I know I'm talking about soccer, but even the girls in the hurling and the Gaelic football, or the camogie and the Gaelic football in Ireland. And, you know, my girls have the likes of Katie McCabe and these girls to look up to, rather than a Ronaldo and Messi.
Yeah.
It's keeping them interested from, you know, speaking to the coaches in the local soccer club when they get to 13, 14, I suppose, to start taking different interests in. And I'm not sure how, I don't have the answers for that one, but how we can maybe still keep it fun for them and...
Fun, I suppose. And I mean, I'm not sure I have the answers either, but I suppose some of it, it's so much, isn't it? So many different reasons they drop out. You've got your body image, you've got puberty, you have the different interests.
There's,
it's that whole thing, really.
Yeah,
and the different pressures
and
of secondary school too,
And studies and what career you want to take. But, you know, some of the girls, you know, I know it's soccer again, it's professional. I think the girls in professional soccer are really taking it to a whole new level.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the rugby has a long way to catch up yet.
Coffee. Can I ask you about coffee? How did you go from rugby to coffee?
It was thanks to rugby I got to experience coffee.
You didn't drink coffee before
Monster.
No,
I didn't. We used to take like caffeine tablets to get a hit before a game.
Oh, okay.
So it was all performance based. Right. And then you start drinking coffee instead of taking the tablets because it's like traveling the world, having Australia, New Zealand, all these places with amazing coffees, all different kind of coffees, and turning out to be nice coffees. It just got me thinking about it. And we seen a roastery in New Zealand in 2012, and I just loved the whole look of it. The guy down in Ozone, he invited us in around the back to see the roastery and explain to us, and, you know, kind of struck a chord with me. There was a lot of labour intense stuff and working with your hands, and, you know, there's a lot of science behind it as well, and I just loved the whole process from, you know, being a bloody cherry and then getting into your cup.
Yeah.
You know, so I was kind of kept that in the back of my mind as I travelled playing rugby. And it was, you know, we got to a stage where we weren't left out and have too many pints to socialise. We started having coffees. So
it's very civilised.
Yeah, during lockdown, and started roasting beans on popcorn makers and nut roasters, and decided to pull the trigger on opening a roastery in Limerick.
And your name, the name, where did the name come from?
Yeah, I get this. I thought it was completely obvious, but 11-14 is the two jerseys I wore on the wing. Like I was either left wing or right wing. So 11-14. I didn't want it to be a rugby coffee. Yeah. I wanted to leave the coffee do the talking, not the name or the association to rugby. So yeah, it was the jerseys I wore. And it was funny, we launched the coffee 11-14, the whole story came out around it. And then Johan van Gran and Steve Larkham decided to play me 13 for a couple of months. I was playing the centre, so everyone was like, you have to go and change 11-14-13. And then the boys were like, oh, you're 23 now as well, you're on the bench. So
you could have gone very messy.
The name could go on forever, so no, we'll stick to 11-14. They're two important numbers.
And are you loving
to me. Yeah, I'm loving it.
Yeah.
I'm loving it. Again, I'm still learning. I'm still trying to figure it all out. I'm only, as I said, it's open 2 years, but I'm just trying to figure out all the costs, how to run an operation, how to run staff, because it's a completely different world to how you speak to a teammate.
Yeah.
The way we speak to each other can be
I can imagine
can be
it's
harsh
a bit different.
And then going in to speak to staff, I could get myself in trouble. So look, made loads of mistakes as well. Made loads of mistakes in the coffee, and I'm all for that, because like made big mistakes, but the learnings, you know, I'm in a way I'm kind of happy I done it now, for when hopefully I'm down the line and the coffee starts to grow and that I don't make bigger mistakes, like, you know. So I'm all for making mistakes. As I said, it was hard to run the business while I was away, and, you know, finding the right people when I wasn't around was hard. And look, thankfully it's been going well since I've retired, and I've been around every day, and I've thrown myself into being a barista. I'm roasting myself, I'm packaging, I'm sourcing beans, I'm doing everything so I can get a good understanding of it. I've good mentors, and I've good people around me, and I've got great staff, and, you know, I've a good following from the Limerick people as well, coming out to the roastery and sitting down, having a coffee and having a chat. Sometimes I get no work done because I'm serving people coffee and they're asking me questions. They're like, are you sure you should be out here doing this? You just have to come off the back of a World Cup. And, you know, why aren't you coaching, or why aren't you retired and in the sunshine? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, you know, unfortunately, rugby gave me a great lifestyle, but it doesn't allow me to retire. It's helped me up nicely. And I suppose that's the unique side of it.
Well, I have a few questions for you now, a few quick fire questions, one of which is a bit coffee based. First thing that comes into your mind, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, so your go-to coffee order?
Short Americano.
Okay. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Okay, I'm with you there. When hidden talent?
Do you know what? I've got really, really good at go-kart racing.
I thought you might say Irish dancing or something. No, I was like, come on, give us an L tune.
We found out at the World Cup.
Go-kart racing.
We've been go-karting a bit and it just seemed to have clicked with me.
Okay.
So I'm not sure I'll get into it professionally. Oh,
I was out there thinking, is there... Is this a new space for us to watch?
I've tried tin whistle and guitar and all this, but...
But go-karting is your
thing. Yeah, yeah. Idel likes her piece in the house. She gives out to me when I try and learn something. I'm all for trying... New stuff, new things. Yeah, yeah.
But she's not subscribing up to the whole tin whistle thing.
No.
This one to me is self-explanatory. Like, I mean, I don't know how this is even a question. But anyway, breakfast for dinner or dinner for breakfast?
I eat breakfast all day long for 3-4 meals.
Okay, it says me saying this going, it's obviously dinner for breakfast. Roast potatoes for breakfast?
No. Don't get me wrong. Edel's Sunday roasts are amazing. But if I was to have a good sourdough, eggs and bacon, I'd have it for the 3 meals of the day, breakfast.
Okay.
Breakfast for dinner.
Okay, we shall agree to disagree on that one.
Yeah.
So, going forward, along with coffee, what are your hopes and dreams for the future, Keith?
It might sound a bit cheesy, but it's to try and live as well and not get sucked into the business world and I suppose give myself freedom and give my girls and myself and Edel, I suppose, carry on the travelling and life experiences and, you know, I suppose just try and leave a legacy behind in the coffee now as well is going to be huge, and I'm excited about how far I can take that. But, you know, I think time is the most important thing we have.
Yeah.
And when I get stressed and, you know, something's annoying me, I'll always ask myself the question as morbid as a sound, I'd be like, when I'm on my deathbed, will this matter or what will I regret? Uh-huh. And, you know, definitely spending time with the girls and, you know, living right, which I think there isn't too many of us doing at the moment. That's what hopefully the future holds for me.
I think you're dead right. Isn't it time? The one thing that we all are so short of and that we don't prioritise. So. What has fatherhood taught you?
Not to take things too seriously.
Right.
I think... And I'm glad you asked the question. I think our kids sometimes are our biggest teachers.
Yeah.
You know, the way, you know, sometimes they're fearless and they're just themselves and just their imagination and just the way they go about things. Yeah. And, you know, they taught me, you know, is to enjoy the moment, isn't it? And it's the small things that matter to them. And, you know, you learn a lot from them, how excited they get for, you know, the smallest of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's up to us as adults is not to take that away from them as well and leave them be. So again, easier said than done. It's, it's just the way the kids live in the moment.
Thank you so much, Keith Earls, for taking the time to chat with us today. And if you've enjoyed today's chats, please do tell a friend or give us a share. If there's a guest that you'd love us to have on, do get in touch at aldi.ie/mamia. Aldi's popular baby and toddler event returns to stores nationwide on the 1st of April with brilliant bargains on a wide range of products, including award-winning Mammy and Appies, Graco strollers, toys, books, kiddies' cutleries, and lots more. So put it in your diary because you won't want to miss it.
We're winners, baby. We've won the National Parenting Product Award for Best Family Supermarket. From our fabulous Mamiya range of organic food, nappies, wipes and snacks, to our pocket-friendly groceries, parents across Ireland know that Aldi is the perfect place to shop. And now we've got the trophy to prove it. What else could you wish for from our Mamiya range? A podcast? Way ahead of you. And that's a winner too. Honestly, we couldn't be nappier. Aldi, every day amazing.